Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. Hi, Spanners here. It's a rest weekend in Formula One, an increasingly rare one, but the fast race cars are winging their way over to Australia as we speak. So we have a chance to stop and assess how 2022 has changed the on-track action. We'll look at the changes at Albert Park. That's what the racetrack is called in Australia. And we'll look at the DRS dilemma facing the Formula One rulemakers. We'll also ask, when do you own the corner? I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners, so let's be friends. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Here's your panel. I'm joined by Matt Two Rumpets.
Totally not trying to model porpoising at home out of handy materials for reasons.
Nerd. Here's another nerd. It's Kyle Power.
Looking forward to arguing about DRS.
You're wrong, Kyle. And we have race driver Brad Philpott.
Somebody needs to tell Mercedes about non-Newtonian fluid dampers.
Oh, April Fools. I hate it so much. Yes, Brad Philpott there has reminded me that April 1st was just an absolute nightmare for news, but one of the most genuinely funny and could potentially fool people ones was Craig Scarborough's, Scarbs F1's, breakdown of porpoising, Brad. What was it? He said they'd found a solution. Oh, no, Red Bull had found a solution.
I still think that's a really good solution that they should try and explore. He was saying that Red Bull had a non-Newtonian fluid damper, which basically firms up the fluid inside with movement, and that was stopping the porpoising. To me, that sounds like something which they definitely should look at.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was very good. But I think tonight I really wanted to focus in on the driving elements of Formula One and how they've changed in 2022. So I think a good one to start with will be Kyle, because I know me and him can have an argument. What is your beef with VRS? You are a grumpy VRS, DRS. You're a grumpy old man, Kyle. That's the problem. You're just one of these, in the olden days, we never had central heating and there was cracks in the road, but people could live in them. You've become a grumpy curmudgeon. And what's your beef with DRS?
Absolutely. I mean, back in my day, we had to die three times before we could get to watch the Grand Prix. Well, I've got a bit of beef with DRS now because the new regulations have seemingly proved so successful in the cars being able to follow that now I think DRS is way, way too powerful. So hence we saw the DRS games with Leclerc and Verstappen down into the last corner, double DRS zones. And also the zones just seem too long. So DRS, when it was put in, was always intended not to affect a pass. It was intended to put you into a position to be able to pass, not to actually give you the pass. But now it's almost a guaranteed pass. If you're within 0.5 of a second behind a car going into a DRS zone, it's a guaranteed pass. So I don't think that's a healthy thing, and I think we need to trim it back a bit.
Okay, you know, we have to remember why DRS came in the first place. It came in a formula. In fact, when did it come in? Do we remember the year?
2011,
so relatively recently. So it's been around for 10 years, and it was introduced in a formula maybe where overtaking was a bit more of a struggle. But if you look at, I don't know, the last 4 or 5 years, I know people have complained about lack of overtaking, and there's an improvement this year. But really, the last 4 or 5 years, there was a lot of arguments already to start making changes to DRS, and some tracks going, well, let's just not have it at this track.
Yeah, and in in 2011, we kind of had a double whammy, because I believe that was the first year with the Pirelli tyres, and with them, you know, and their high degradation and thermal degradation issues, we started to get great and mixed up races anyway. And when the tyres went a little bit more conservative, that came out. So I think, I still think it's a necessary evil, but I just think it's too overpowered now. We've got used to it. So you say we've had great racing over the last couple of years, and indeed we have, but a vast majority of all the passes we've seen have been what we call DRS passes, when they just black passed on the straight. They haven't been desperate lunges into braking zones. And I think we're at the stage now, with the regulation seeming to work, that we can reduce the power of it and put it more back into having to have a late lunge on the brakes.
Right. So I would answer that with saying baby bathwater. The Saudi Arabia track in particular, Jeddah, is unusual in that it has 3 DRS zones in a row. I don't believe that's the case at most tracks. So I want to see a few more races. I like the idea, like they did with DRS in the beginning, of maybe tuning it over the weekend, making it longer or shorter as they observe on-track action, and especially with the other classes, getting the racing done sooner.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, they used to tweak with it quite a lot. Used to hear it quite a lot.
Yeah.
And then during the, going into Saturday morning, oh, they've changed the DRS zone length in here. And they don't seem to do that now. So the DRS, they seems to have left from the old era of cars. It seems so weird calling 2021 the old era, but it's true. So it's set up and tuned for them. And you know, again, in Bahrain, it was a bit too powerful on the main straight. And the big thing is, we've had 2 tracks successively that have had consecutive DRS zones, and I don't think that's a good thing. So this causes this shenanigans with coming up on the first DRS is really powerful, puts you in a position to pass, but you don't want to pass because you know there's another DRS zone immediately afterwards. What's going to be really interesting when we get to a track like Canada, when they have the DRS zone all the way down the back straight into the flip-flop chicane, then they have another one into turn one, whether we start seeing those shenanigans into turn one, because they'll be able to follow each other better through the chicanes.
Yeah, I think I see all that, Carl, but the problem that we might face here is that F1 2022 has delivered these 2 already iconic battles, and it's hard now to go back. And are you going to tell me that you could walk into that FIA board meeting about what they're going to do about DRS? In fact, we'll go to Matt on that. What we're going to do about DRS, and tell them, I want to make some changes for the good of the sport and for what I believe the racing should be. Now, it will mean that we won't have any of those swappy backwards and forwards. You're going to get chucked out of a window. Make sure you don't have that meeting on the 50th floor, would be my suggestion.
Well, I agree. I think what you're looking at here is, it's not going to be perfect, whatever you do. So the question is, if I'm going to make a mistake, do I make a mistake where there is more overtaking and more back and forth battling, or less? And right now, after the years in the wilderness we've had, I'm saying, if they're going to make a mistake, okay, well, let's have a little too much DRS, because look at how much fun it is to watch.
Yeah, what's the harm, Kyle? What is the harm in having the battles like we've had the last 2 races? Does it really matter? I mean, the faster car and the better driver is still going to have an advantage and win out. Isn't it just more interesting?
It is, and I don't want to be the guy who says, let's ruin a good thing. So I think Matt had a good point of, we may well gorge on it this year and just have overtaking overload. But my issue is, I don't want overtaking to become cheap. It's the same reason why I don't think 30 Grand Prix a year is a good thing. Too much of a thing, it can oversaturate it. So we want to make, you know, before, you know, back in the noughties, back in the 90s, overtakes were they were few and far between, but they were special when they happened. I think we're kind of losing that special bit of the overtake when it's just a DRS overtake. So I think we can just trim it back a bit, and I'd rather have less overtaking of a higher quality than more loads of DRS overtakes, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I do want to say that Tim in the chat room has brought up an interesting point. He says, doesn't DRS help with porpoising, therefore having a double effect? And that actually might be a reason why they're not messing with it yet.
Oh, because when you open DRS, you get less porpoising, so it's helping them out? No, that can't be. I cannot believe that they would make a racing decision like that based on a condition that only happens when you're following another car. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, I think what Matt means is when it allows teams to run a bit closer, because when you open the DRS flap, it takes the aero load off and reduces the porpoising. So I think the FIA would be happy to leave it at the moment, because if they take it away completely, the cars would be bouncing around and wouldn't get anywhere near each other. So it's actually alleviating the problem. But what they said in the chat room was maybe highlighting that it's making the DRS exaggerated. It's making it way more powerful than it should be if the cars weren't porpoising, because the car in front is porpoising, the car behind opens its DRS, loses its aero load and stops porpoising and gets an extra boost because of it.
Okay. So because I'm slightly bored of porpoising just as a topic in general, I'm going to focus on the racing element of it and go to you, Brad. Is this an unsatisfying form of racing where every pass is effectively a DRS pass and lining yourself up for DRS is more important than some of the things that you will have gone through in karting and single seaters and sports cars of, like, you know, sitting in the blind spot, dummying someone? Like, are we losing some of the actual art of racing?
Yes, in a way. But I think it's very tricky because Formula One is an extreme form of motorsport. And by that, I mean, you've got very, very powerful aero, which is here to stay. We're going to have wings and aero that helps the cars go fast around the corners, which naturally makes it very hard to follow. So it is different to other motorsports. So we can't really judge it in the same way as you judge touring cars or something that's, you know, much less aero dependent. So I kind of feel like, although I don't like DRS either as a concept, it feels impure. It's not proper overtakes. Yeah. I kind of feel like we're in this position where we do need something like this in order to make the racing viable at all. Because even with the improved ability to follow this year, I still think overtaking would be a little bit too difficult without something like DRS. There are other ways to do this. You can have a system a little bit like IndyCar, where you have a finite amount of push to pass to use during a race, a certain number of seconds. And you can use that strategically. You can use it all at once. You can use it to make overtakes. You can use it to do fast laps in clear air. But ultimately, everyone's got the same amount. And if you've run out when you need to make an overtake, that's kind of on you. So I think maybe I'd prefer that than, I don't know, for some reason that feels a little bit less artificial than opening a flap and just driving past on a straight. But I'm not 100% sure why.
Yeah, and I get what Brad's saying, and I agree. I think it's a necessary evil, even still at the moment. I wouldn't want to get rid of it entirely, but I think it needs to be massively reduced in power. And as Danny Henney points out in the live chat, the DRS is brought in to get the cars alongside into braking zones, not past the car in front with 300 meters still to go to the braking zone. And that's kind of my point. I think it's a little bit overpowered. So I actually think at the moment I could stick my neck out and say they could probably halve a lot of the DRS zones, and we would probably be seeing some more sort of dramatic braking zones at the end of the straights as a result.
Yeah, and I think, but I think, Kyle, people aren't going to, in the decision-making realm, when they hear the marketing people and they go out and do focus groups, because I'm imagining that now in Formula One, they do what they do with movies and TV shows. This is a complete guess, but I'm guessing they get a bunch of people in the room that have just watched the race and they do these focus groups, you know, test groups. What did you think of the thing? And they're going to say, well, we loved the bit with where the cars were swapping places. That was incredible. And that is going to take precedent over grumpy Kyle, who's been watching F1 since 1986, Matt.
Yeah, and I'm going to be very generous and say that Kyle is not entirely wrong.
No, I agree with Carl. My thing is reality of what's going to happen.
But I think we also have to accept we've seen a lot of battles that were more than just, oh, buy and into turn one and gone. We saw multiple times, multiple cars, and I'm thinking of Alonso and Ocon in particular, not just fighting through turns two, three, and four before one or the other gets an advantage, but then doing it all over again the next lap around. And to me, I think the DRS is helping with that a little bit right now. So just be careful what you wish for. That's all I'm saying.
I know. Brad, with your push-to-pass idea with the extra power, I wonder if it might solve a suggestion that keeps getting poo-pooed for DRS when I make it, which is that when you're alongside, the DRS flap would like close. And people always say, oh, well, that's too dangerous to suddenly introduce a braking force of aero. But to me, the point would be it's something to get you alongside. With your push-to-pass Dubry what's it, could that not be disabled once you get side-by-side so it can't give you any extra advantage?
Yeah, I actually really like that as a concept. I take issue with the DRS closing.
That's what everyone says.
Alongside. No, I take issue with that being dangerous because if you're still accelerating, then you're not decelerating. You're accelerating at less of a rate. But unless there's someone else behind you also with DRS open, and they're not paying attention, that's the only situation that could be an issue. So I think that's a good idea, Spanners. I think if there was a way to, you know, you could just have a sensor at some point on the car and it was in like, you know, where the driver was or something like that. And then when they meet up, it stops. I think that's quite a good idea.
I think we get poo-pooed for a lot of these suggestions because people say it's too complicated. I just want to quickly just point out from like a technology point of view, sensing where cars are on track, things for like track limits or in adjacent to another car, those things aren't technologically difficult. They can be implemented because just heading off a couple of emails, Matt.
No. And I would just, if we're going to be fixing Formula One, I would like to throw in the suggestion that Brad said with push to pass, why not give each driver, I don't know, 5 minutes of DRS and a whole race, and they can use it whenever they want. They don't have to be close to people. They can be in front and use it and defending if they like, but just give them a limited time of DRS and use it when they want. And then it becomes part of the strategy.
So the reason that I prefer this, and I don't like the name push to pass because that makes it sound like you could just push a button and you overtake. It's not like that. It's just a slight power increase for the duration that you're pressing the button. But the thing I prefer about that to DRS is that DRS is dangerous if you're using it in the wrong place. So if the drivers could use DRS, say, anywhere they wanted, they could just open it up in the middle of a corner, we've seen what happens when that goes wrong.
At Abbey, we saw Grosjean with the DRS flap open at Silverstone, didn't we? When that was part of a DRS zone.
Yeah, and also, if it fails. I know they're made in a way that they fail into the safer position, but the point being that you can use a push-to-pass button anywhere, and you know you can use that strategically in a different way. So I've just never been a particular fan of the DRS system itself. Has always seemed a little bit strange to me. And I'd rather we had a different system.
It was a sticking plaster, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I apologize. But yeah, I meant only in the DRS zones, not anywhere on the track. But your push to pass could be interesting if they were allowed to increase the fuel flow to get extra power, for example. Like right now they have limited fuel flow. Maybe that would be a way to do it. But I think we're veering off topic.
Now, just a few live chat comments there. There's a suggestion about KERS, which basically KERS was that, wasn't it? You had a certain amount of battery power you could use, and then that swiftly got taken away. So bring back KERS, hashtag bring back KERS. I don't know, or something like it. There's lots of stuff like these ideas I'm sure are knocking about, but it's fun to talk about them. Paddy says the F1 focus groups must have cataracts then. And talking about my focus groups that I was talking about, I would imagine those focus groups would not be just roomfuls of Kyles and Paddies. Those focus groups will have a broad demographic of people from brand new fans to older fans. And look at the markets that they're looking at. You know, a new US market, which is nothing against American F1 fans at all, but it is broadly speaking a higher percentage of newer people who don't have the good old days that Kyle's harking back to compare to. And they're just being asked, what were the best bits? What made you excited? What made you want to stay tuned in? Anyway, Kyle.
Yeah, I don't mind DRS that much because it's done in a safe and controlled way. I quite like the push to pass concept. But one thing for Formula One that I think that may stagnate into is it will kind of equal itself out. So everyone will be using it at roughly the same times. There will be optimum times and optimum places to use it as a boost on track, like out of corners. It'll be much more effective under acceleration than it will at at Vmax at velocity at the end of the straight. So it will probably work out that everyone will be doing exactly the same thing. And then we could just be waiting for laps until one runs out first before the other one does. So I think it could neutralize itself.
Yeah, people do have a habit of taking those new fresh things and then being able to hone down on it. Like the Pirelli tires, for example, at first it was chaos. Then everyone started to get their head around it, you know, and they have to change it again to mix things up. A bit of hope for you, Kyle. Bahrain and the Jeddah track are perhaps the least representative for how DRS in modern F1 might work. Remember, we're going to Albert Park next, which is a track which frankly needs help. In fact, we could just do, before we go on to our next race control stuff, we could look at the new changes at Albert Park. But traditionally, Kyle, that has been a track where, you know, we've got all excited about the F1 season and then street circuit.
Yeah, it's ended up being a damp squib. I know a lot of people like that phrase. But it's no longer. So it no longer should be like that, because this year they have made quite a lot of sweeping track changes. They have widened it into turn one and made that a bit faster and wider. And then going into the traditional overtaking spot on Albert Park, which is turn three, yeah, that really tight bit, they've made that a lot wider as well. They've done away with the really awkward right-hander, you know, where the camera shot looks at them and they as they come towards you, when Kobayashi had the massive crash a few years ago. They've completely made that a really fast corner now and got rid of the flip-flop chicane afterwards. So it's a flat-out straight,
yeah,
basically from like turn five or six, all the way down, okay, to the super fast flip-flops, like the amazing ones you want to go through, then into another wide corner and a braking zone. So they have completely changed the dynamics, right, of the track. And initially, when I looked at it, I was like, that's not a good idea because they're not going to be able to follow. But it's like they almost knew the new regulations were going to be successful, because the new style of tracks that they're making, and they've made Albert Park into one. Now I'm really, really excited about Albert Park. I think for the first time ever, I'm excited about the racing we will see wheel to wheel there, because this new formula seems to deliver.
And don't forget, for the first time in I think quite some time, we're going to have a gap in our tires. We're going for the 2, the 3, and the 5, the softest of all tires. It's going to be an entirely resurfaced track. And you left off, they've widened the pit lane, and they might be increasing the pit lane speed limit to 80 kilometers from 60 kilometers, which might bring different strategies into play. I know that's the plan. I don't think it's been confirmed yet if they're going to do it.
And I think that's quite major. So an extra 20 kph in the pit lane, the penalty for pitting is going to be much less now. It's going to be a fair few seconds shorter, which then all the strategists looking at all of their graphs and their lines, all of a sudden an aggressive three stop or an aggressive two stop is going to become a much more attractive prospect to do now. And as you say, especially with the gap in the tires, with the C5, the softest tires, they're essentially going to have a qualifying tire. So if some of them keep hold of that for the race, it might be worth it to run a super aggressive final stint on some brand new softs with a minimum pit lane time penalty. So it's gonna be fascinating to see if they can get that in place, because as we understand, it's not actually been given the go-ahead yet. They need to just assess it when they get there, but they've moved the pit wall right up to the side of the circuit, so there's no grass at the side of the circuit now where Daniel Ricciardo lost, yeah, his front wing, yeah, back in, I think it was for his first race for Red A. So there's no grass now. He would have been in a wall back then. So, but if that gives us a faster pit lane, I think that's good.
Okay, so there's a few things there to break down. Firstly, I want to get to qualifying, but concentrating on the track, I lost track of like which chicane was flip-flop. Is that the one in the middle before the famous kind of the sort of sweeping straight that goes to the left, and then you've got kind of a more, a looser, bigger chicane left-right? Is the flip-flop the one before that?
Correct. Right, okay. The palm tree lined, you know, the classic, yeah, left, yeah, with the yellow lines on the thing, and it gets to the super fast 11 and 12 chicane, whereas now, well, previously that kind of would have really broken them up. But as we saw in Jeddah, it looks like it doesn't trouble the car behind too much. And it's more of a sort of a driver skill now. So coming down to the corner after that, they've winded that and made the braking zone a bit bigger, I think. So especially with these heavy cars, and we've got slightly increased braking zones as well.
Yeah,
that should, ooh, become the hot place for overtaking now rather than turn three.
Oh, it would be nice to have one more than one overtaking spot there. But Matt, just... I completely get what you said about the tyres and understand the new qualifying format. But for anyone listening that doesn't, say the things, let's clarify. So during FP quali 1, 2, 3, 5 cars get knocked out in each one. Then in the last one, they fight for the top 10 places. used to have Q2, you qualified on a tire, and there was some tactics there because you could qualify on a better race tire if you thought you could make it. So now, are we going to have people qualifying on the soft tire, but that doesn't carry on into the race, does it? So they don't have to like save the tires. Everyone will still qualify on the softest tire and then choose what they're on in qualifying.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you wanted to be very engineering, you'd say they will pick the optimum tire for qualifying, but that will almost certainly be the softest tire. And what's interesting about Australia is they are bringing the C2 and the C3 tires.
Okay.
But instead of the C4, which normally they would just bring right next to each other number-wise, they're actually bringing the very softest tire they make. So there's a gap between what we were going to be calling the medium tire and the soft tire that we don't normally have.
All right, Kyle, tell me if I've got this right. So if you can save some of that very softest tire, you've got basically a sprint tire to use somewhere in the race. And if these are multi-stop races, that could be interesting, couldn't it? That's a way to change your position in the pack, even if only kind of temporarily.
Yeah. So, because of the rules, I doubt we will be seeing many of the soft tires through practice. There might be one or two, maybe runs as a qualifier, but it's essentially because it's a whole step different. So instead of a delta of 0.8 of a second between the tires, it's probably going to be about 1.2, 1.4. But because it's two steps softer than the next hardest tire they can have, it's probably going to fall apart and be quite firmly sensitive. So it's going to be fascinating to see how many of them they keep. Some teams might just not want to use it in the race at all. They'll keep it as purely as a qualifying tire, and then they'll just change straight onto the mediums and the hards. But other teams, like you say, might want to take a gamble, might want to keep a nice brand new set of those qualifying tires for maybe a 10-lap dash at the end to work through the pack.
And to me, the joker is they've resurfaced the whole track. No one knows what the degradation on these tires is really going to be until they get out there and start running them. And think about other brand new circuits or resurfaced circuits and how that changed the degradation profile of the tires. It could.
And what's really fascinating is Pirelli are usually super conservative when they've come to a change of tarmac. They usually bring tires that are not far too hard, but it's a nailed on one stop. Now they're bringing the fastest tire in the range and the softest tire they have. Makes me think that they're not going too conservative. And I'm really hoping we're going to go back to a 2011 of having maybe even a 3 or 4 stop and the tires falling to bits and it just being carnage. I really hope the tires are too soft for the track, because I think that will give us dramatic strategy and races.
Some people just want to watch the world burn.
Absolutely. Well, I think regardless, I think between the track changes and the tires they're bringing, it's going to be a very exciting race weekend at Australia. And I, for one, am completely looking forward to it.
All right. Let's talk rules. But first, I want to just preview what's coming up a little bit. I have to have some good news, bad news for our patrons. Our patron show on Tuesday that we are going to do is cancelled, but it is for a good reason, because we had an opportunity to catch up with a top F1 media person. I shan't tease any more. Will Buxton is going to drop into the shed to have a chat with us. And of course, Will Buxton has been everybody's F1 teacher on Drive to Survive and has been deep in the heart of F1 as an organization. So we'll be taking some listener questions and do a bit of blue sky thinking, and we'll fix Formula One with Will Buxton. And then the Tuesday after that, we're catching up with F1 stat man Sean Kelly. So the man who gives everyone their statistics on just about every media platform. So we really are spoiled for content. And in between that, we're going to have the Australian Grand Prix race review. It will still be at 8 o'clock, even though nearly a whole day will have passed. You're going to get up early in the morning, watch that race, but we're still going to get together in the evening for our race review of that. So join us 8 p.m. UK time live. So an exciting week coming up, and then we will try and hook up some extra Patreon content after that. If you do want to support us on Missed Apex Podcast, go to patreon.com/MissedApex. You'll get the extra content when we're not flooded with an embarrassment of amazing guests, and join our patron only chat forums and get an ad free feed as well. Okay, let's talk about some racy car stuff. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Spanish.
What do you think of the stewarding? I have comments. I have some issues. New race control people. new ways of doing things, lots of promises about how races would be marshaled and how rules would be implemented. What's your take?
Yeah, so I kind of want to reserve judgment a bit longer.
No,
before I
snap to a conclusion.
I'll give you my initial impressions. Yeah. So I certainly liked the noises that were coming out of the direction of race control before the season started about being stricter on certain driving practices, stricter with track limits, that kind of thing. I think we've seen some examples of inconsistency already, and some examples of the kind of wrong decision that you just expect with any race control. I've come to expect with my old years now, my very old age, watching lots of racing, that we're never going to get stewards who necessarily police things the way that we might want them done, whether that's consistency or just their view on the fault that certain people are or aren't at in certain incidents. But I'm kind of hopeful. I'm still hopeful that the stewards that we've got this year, the race directors, are going to come through as the season progresses and keep on top of certain things, keep on top of drivers running too wide or forcing other drivers off the track. I just haven't seen enough yet to confidently state whether or not they're doing a good or bad job. But we do have some examples, I think, from Saudi Arabia that we can talk about.
Okay, so it's good to clarify that there's two separate things that often get conflated. So one is race control, and last season that was Michael Massey, and this season it's been split between two people, I believe, and they've got a bit more support, and they've got backup and teams like that. And then the stewarding is a completely different thing. So the stewarding is about making decisions that have been referred to them. So there's contact on track, and then they decide, you know, whose fault is it? So I think we're going to start with the stewarding side of that, Brad. And I've got a little bit of a question, which might feel like a loaded question because you're a driver. But should we not have ex-racing drivers, and this is going to sound stupid, as the stewards, because you've all done proper naughty stuff. I've seen you, Brad, behave despicably on a go-kart track and take every little advantage. Are you not going to be guilty if you're a steward of a race to go, I would have done that too?
So I think there's good arguments to have former drivers and maybe good arguments against it as well. But I think you could probably level those same arguments at basically anybody in that role. Former drivers may well be from an era where certain things were acceptable that aren't any longer, or they may well... They're not necessarily going to have the objective, level-headed judgment that a professional steward who knows the rule book inside out and knows exactly how rules are supposed to be applied, having done it for years and looked at lots of different incidents, may well judge things. Having said that, I also don't think we have that anyway. I don't think we've got those people doing the stewarding role. We've got one of the stewards' roles filled each time by someone who just happens to be head of the local motorsport governing authority. They're kind of doing it as a jolly for the weekend. So that kind of thing seems like it's maybe more of a pressing thing to change. And I know you said that race control or the race director and the stewards are separate things, and they are.
Yeah.
I feel pretty strongly that the decisions that the stewards come to are led by the culture set by the race director. They may not be making the ultimate decisions, you know, the ones making the votes, but I kind of feel like they will have discussions and they will set the ground rules ahead of time. And that then that kind of pattern will be followed by the stewards during the races.
Yeah. The way I look at it, and I'm not sure if it's correct or not, the way I look at it is that the stewards are sort of the jury and the race control is essentially the judge.
Ooh,
and the judge
nice.
Has to essentially, he has to refer things to the stewards, to jury, so then they, whoever they are, come up with their decision and come back with a verdict. It's like when we had the problem at Turn 4 in Brazil last year, whereas the director didn't even refer it to the stewards to look at. So that's why there wasn't a decision, because it wasn't even referred to them. So I kind of agree with Brad. I think we need to leave it a little bit longer before we can see how the system sort of works. But I think it's very healthy to have a driver in there, a former driver from whatever era, because you'd always want a representative who knows what it's like in a car, wheel to wheel, rather than Jimmy from the supermarket and someone else, you know, sort of there who've never really driven a race car before and probably won't see it from a driver's view. So I think it's important to have that driver representation there.
Jimmy? I've never heard of Jimmy. I've heard of Derek, Brad.
I think what Carl's saying there, what he's implying there, is it leads to exactly what I was saying about the culture being set by the race director. Because if he refers certain things to the stewards and doesn't refer other things, it's kind of by default saying these are things that we potentially don't want happening, and these are things that I'm fine with. So just the fact that he has that power kind of leads to that conclusion.
So everyone knows I love doing research, and although I may have read every single race decision from the stewards that's come out in the first two races as part of getting ready for the show, I've not gone back and looked at the rules. But to my memory, the stewards can choose to view an incident on their own. Race control doesn't have to refer it to them. And this is where Brad's suggestion makes me think of tennis and the way they run their rules and the way they pick the people who make the line calls and stuff like that. I feel like we do need some leaders who are professionally trained and are one of the four or six people that will be leading the stewards, like the foreman on a jury, for example, from American jurisprudence, through the case, whatever the call is, and are confident enough that if they see something, even if the race director doesn't pick up on it, they're going to go, we're going to look at this anyway because we think it's a violation of the rule.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, the thing is, let's look at some specific examples here. So I've said that I didn't think Albon, and I'm not an Albon fan, so don't accuse me of being an Albon Fosse, but, you know, I am vocally anti-Stroll a lot of time, so that doesn't help this case. But I did think that it was really silly that Albon got a penalty for being alongside Stroll and then Stroll turning into him. Now, in our Slack group earlier, we shared a video that's doing the rounds on Reddit, and it's 14 incidents of Lance Stroll in F1 just turning into the apex when there's a car there and crunching the car on the inside. What was interesting is, and this definitely does seem to be a Stroll thing, and you remember FP2 famously with Max Verstappen, where he crunched the inside. Obviously, that wasn't in a race. What's interesting is that in none of those situations did Lance Stroll get called out for being in the wrong, and I don't think he got a penalty for any of them either. Yet in all those situations, bar one maybe, where Sainz came out of the pit lane, appeared up at the inside on cold tyres, and maybe you could argue that that was more Sainz's fault. But in most of those situations, I'm following the Brad Philpott lane system, and my general feeling with those racing rules, Brad, is, you know, you can't turn where a car exists. So if there's a car there and you turn in, it's your fault for having turned in. But I find myself on the wrong side of most of these stewarding decisions. And the phrase that kept coming up over and over on the commentary was, oh, well, he owned the corner. He had that corner. It was his corner. Brad, when do you own a corner? When's it your corner?
Yeah, okay. Thanks for phrasing it like that, because that makes it really difficult for me to explain.
Good.
Just for any new listeners who haven't heard this whole lane system thing Spanner just referred to, it's just... it's something which should be a rule, but isn't a rule.
Yeah.
That I use to judge who is moving towards whom in a situation, and essentially who was the one that needed to stop moving towards the other person, who actually caused the crash. And sometimes it applies in these situations where you've got a car turning in on another one. You ask who owns the corner, or when do you own a corner? And it's a little bit situation specific, but I do like to try and apply slightly more black and white rules to these things than stewards or race control.
Yeah, let's start with a broad brush, and then we can obviously get into nuance.
If there is a car next to you, if there's a car on a piece of track that you want to use, you can't use that piece of track. It's kind of a simple, that's at its most extreme form, it's as simple as that. However, when that car arrives on that piece of track that you want to use, does come into it in certain situations. So let me just try and give a couple of quick examples.
Yeah.
If you're in a battle with a car, you're ahead of them, and just as you turn into the corner and just before you reach the apex, that other car suddenly arrives, whether under control, out of control, or whatever.
The dive bomb.
A dive bomb in its most extreme sense. They weren't there, and just before you drive onto that piece of track you wanted, they're there. You could leave them room. If you saw it in time, you could leave them room. You'll both live to fight another day, and it's probably in your best interest. But if you have a crash, if you do make contact, you probably wouldn't blame the driver ahead, because the other person appeared so late, you can't really expect them to have seen it.
But if you're the driver coach in that situation, you might say to that driver, hey, we could have finished that race today if you'd had just enough awareness and just opened up at the end.
Yeah, but my most extreme example I'm trying to use here,
yeah,
it's so late that you wouldn't expect them to necessarily have known it was coming. They're already focusing on the corner exit or something else. However, the most aware drivers may well still have an eye on the mirror at that point and give the room and live to fight another day.
Matt, just before you move on, Matt, I know you had a quick point on that.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask Brad because, you know, they did come out with updated overtaking rules. And specifically, they said among the various factors, let's say we're making overtake up the inside, they will consider if the overtaking car's front tires are alongside the other car by no later than the apex of the corner. And I just wanted to ask, does that make sense according to your system? And does that seem like that's maybe a little different than what we've used in the past?
Brad's making a face.
So if the front wheels of the overtaking car are alongside the car ahead by the apex, is that what you said?
No later than.
I mean, why would it be late? If it's later than the apex, then the other car's already made the apex, so yeah, the overtake can't happen. So that doesn't really work in that wording as far as I can see it. And that seems like they're giving leeway to the overtaking car in a more extreme way than I would probably judge it. Now, I'm saying the example I just gave was kind of one end of the spectrum. The car arrives there at the very last moment, and the car ahead, who's defending effectively, wouldn't necessarily be expected to know they were there. I just wanted to give the other end of that.
So
the other extreme is there is a car next to you, alongside you, all the way to the braking zone and through the turn-in phase, and you still try and take the apex. In that situation, the blame should really be apportioned wholly on the driver turning in, because they've had every chance to know you were there, or know the overtaking car was there. They were there the whole time. They never disappeared. They were always there, and yet you still tried to take the apex. So that's kind of pretty easy to judge that it was the turning in car's fault. And then you've got every situation in between those two where
you could argue that
there was a move was probably going to happen, so you probably should have been looking in your mirrors, or they were almost alongside or kind of hovering there. There's lots and lots of different moves on that spectrum of overtakes where you could apportion more or less blame to either driver. And I feel like the Albon move, if that's what we're going to talk about specifically at Saudi Arabia, was somewhere towards the second example I gave, where the car was kind of always there. It wasn't like he suddenly was at the apex just before Stroll arrived. Stroll turned in whilst the car was already there. So that puts at least a large proportion of the fault on the turning in car to leave that room.
Matt, just a quick one.
Yeah, this is the question I wanted to ask. If I turned Alex Albon and his car into a block of cement and set him on the apex there, it looked like to me Stroll was going to hit him anyway. Is that your impression of it as well as a driver?
Yeah, I think Stroll's argument would be that he was entitled to the corner or whatever, or that Albon's move was too late or something like that. And I heard you say pre-show that part of the steward's decision to penalize Albon was that he'd locked his brakes and therefore that showed that he was out of control. But I really don't buy that, because you'll lock your brakes for various different reasons. And it seemed to me that Albon locked up when he realized Stroll was driving towards him. And it was kind of a last ditch attempt to avoid the contact. It was like Albon was trying to do Stroll's job for him, and still there was contact, and still Albon was the one that got penalized. So I don't really buy that. I think, and that's the kind of lame justification that I wish the stewards wouldn't give. I wish they would apply more of a strict framework to judging these decisions, rather than, you know, I mean, that's such an easily debunked reason for them to give that it was Albon's fault. That kind of thing shouldn't really enter into it.
They have tried to kind of cover this off and almost empower the stewards in a way with these overtaking guidelines, which haven't been fully published, but a few of them. And there's a couple of really important bits in this that we've seen from the words. And one of them is the phrase that you have to, if you're the defender and a car is attacking you, you have to leave them space on the inside or the outside. So if you're saying that Stroll didn't leave them space, then that's fair enough. It's a slam dunk. Stroll does say that he actually left him space. And I'm trying to look at a steward here and try to justify why they came up with that decision. Because Stroll said he left space. They'll be able to see it on the data, and he does look a little bit wider. I think why Albon was penalised was that he actually hits the curb on the inside, because Stroll has forced him onto there, but yeah, he's hit the curb, and that's bounced him into Stroll. And he has bounced, and you can see there's a clear movement from the Williams from as soon as he hits the curb, sharp outside into Stroll. But I agree with Brad. Stroll should have left more room, and they both would have lived to fight another day. But it's quite important that the wording changes they have made in these overtaking guidelines. So, and I don't think they've been applied really properly on this steward's decision. So that's surprising.
Yeah. So I think actually Kyle and Brad there, Matt, are sort of loudly agreeing with each other that the Albon was forced into the situation that ended up making him make contact.
I would agree. And I think it feeds back into Brad's point about the culture. We've changed the rules, but the steward's culture hasn't yet updated itself.
Right. And I just want to make the point that I'm actually not saying this is 100% Stroll's fault. I actually think in this situation, racing incident may well be a decent decision. I know you don't like that. But so I'm certainly not saying this is completely Stroll's fault. What an idiot. Stroll does have a history of being, as Matt put it earlier, apex blind, you know, getting to a certain point on the approach to a corner and then just entirely ignoring his mirrors, where, you know, there is still legitimate time for a car to appear and they're allowed to be there after Stroll has already kind of switched his focus. So you do need to reserve some of your peripheral vision and attention to the mirrors at that point of a corner, particularly if you're in a battle. It's not like a car's come from 10 seconds back and suddenly they're there. You know, you should be aware that you're in a fight. Yeah. And at some point, if you no longer know where they are, if you don't know for certain where that car is, you're almost obliged to leave room in case they're in the place you're turning towards. You should know where they are. So anyway, I'm not apportioning 100% blame at all to Stroll in this situation. He just does have previous, and this is a little bit indicative of some of the other things he's done in the past.
Well, Toby W in the live chat points out one of those, which is Tsunoda in Brazil. And that was one of the incidents that was on that clip, Brad. And the commentary was, oh, a bit optimistic there. And it was one of these situations where he kind of appeared at turn one. But by the time, like before they were turning in, Tsunoda's there, Kyle. So I think what Brad's pointed out is there's two different factors, where you are on track and when you appear there. Obviously, if it was on a straight, it's not really controversial at the start. If you move over, even if someone's wing is there, that's your stupid fault for having moved over and taken their wing. But on the corner, the timing of when they appear, but I'm glad that this is at least being addressed, because we've had so long in F1 with it just being kind of like a vague coin toss.
Yeah. In Stroll's defense, for balance, is with the Brazil one with Tsunoda come from miles back.
Yes.
It was a huge
so
dive
more
bomb.
Extreme.
And as Brad said, we were discussing this earlier in the group chat that, Stroll does seem in a certain phase of the corner entry to switch off the mirrors and put the blinkers on like you put on horses, and is just purely focused on what's happening ahead of him and not alongside him. So we actually see this in the Abu Dhabi incident the Jeddah incident with Albon, that Stroll only starts giving him space reactionary when he can see Albon's flying towards him on the inside. He opens the wheel, whereas he's in the battle. He really shouldn't have turned in that early anyway, and maybe left a bit more room, but he did sort of react. But in a lot of on that on that sort of crash reel, so to speak, that we saw earlier, the streamable thing, a lot of them were that Stroll had already committed the corner. Once he commits, he turns off his peripheral vision and just goes for it. Now, that's kind of okay, but he doesn't really react. It's not self-preservation. So always, and as Brad said, if you know and you lose sight of where your competitor is, you have to give them the benefit of the doubt, and you have to give your longevity the benefit of the doubt and give space and just save yourself. That's what we saw Hamilton being so effective at last year, was just give the corner up. Just, you know, they're going to be there somewhere on the inside. And what you don't see from the cameras is Formula One cars, they have no vision. They almost have hardly any peripheral vision. It's almost done on a feeling and in their mirrors, and whether they can just see it in the side in their peripheral vision.
Yeah.
So Stroll does seem to turn that off, and he does seem to be the worst driver for it. But again, he can't see much. In his defense, he can't see much. And a lot of them, he has been dive bombed.
Did I hear Kyle or Matt mention that the driving rules haven't been fully published? Because, I mean, for the new transparent FIA governance, that sounds really, I mean, it sounds like what we would expect, but it's very frustrating because we're trying to judge what's allowed and what isn't allowed. And there are rules which we're not allowed to see, which seems bizarre.
Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, well, aside from having been on about the technical directives forever and not knowing what 90% of the actual rules for the sport are, because only the teams get to see them and the teams leak them when they feel it's in their own self-interest, I am actually, having gone through all the decisions, noticing that there was nothing about Perez in the safety car in the officially published documents in the FIA column. So I'm agreeing with Brad about the transparency thing. We've been talking about transparency, but I'm concerned that we're not always seeing it.
Yes, and we can't do anything about that. However, what we can do is we can try and be inconsistent and evolve our own little Mist Apex shed rules. So we could call them the shed rules of F1. We could call them the Brad Philpott lane system. I think where I really want to end on this, actually the Tsunoda example is a good example. And I think a similar one is actually Lewis Hamilton up the inside of Albon as well, where he was given a penalty for spinning Albon around. When is it too late? And there's a reason Interlagos is the track that brings these situations up, because these are tracks where you can successfully make separate lines and go up the inside, Kyle. So when do you think is it too late? Because I looked at the Hamilton one and the Tsunoda one, and I thought, oh, inside car, fair punt. Didn't we praise Daniel Ricciardo at Monza? Didn't we praise Daniel Ricciardo for being the last of the late breakers? Do we want to kill the lunge, Kyle?
No, you don't want to kill the lunge, but there is a limit. And we've seen this last year, and in this new updated overtaking guidelines, they actually address this. And there's a very powerful comment in here, which I think addresses what happened in lap one in Abu Dhabi as well with Verstappen and Hamilton. And this is where I think it's too late. If you dive bomb into somebody and you stay on the track, but you give them no ability of staying on the track, then that's too late. Like the one on Albon, look at where the trajectory is going to take him. It was probably taking him right to the outside of the circuit, and there would have been, if the car on the outside would have remained side by side, they would have been forced off. So they actually changed the wording to, the car being overtaken must be able to make the corner while remaining within the track, within the limits of the track, which is, this wasn't in the wording last year, but this is why they let Hamilton keep the position on lap one in Abu Dhabi, because Verstappen dive bombed in and only just stayed on the track himself and left no room for the other car. This is maybe why we're seeing people behaving more this year. So I think that's why that's when it's too late. You have to look at the trajectory of the car, their speed, and probably where they're going to end up after the contact, if they make contact. And if you can clearly see they were going to fly to the outside of the track and crowd the other car off, then that is too late.
Very, very hard to make that judgment at the apex. So like, I look at that Tsunoda incident and go, right, was Tsunoda going to fly off the outside of turn one and force Stroll off? Was Hamilton going to fly off of that corner and force Albon off? I don't think so. But Brad,
you have to allow that situation to develop. And if you're the driver that stops the situation from being able to develop, then in my mind, it's your fault. So,
Okay.
So if you don't, so say, I'm trying to remember the Brazil incident you're talking about with Tsunoda and Stroll, but I assume it's Tsunoda going to the inside of turn one and Stroll turning towards the apex. Yeah, so in that situation, because it never got to play out, because we didn't get to see whether or not Sonoda was never given a chance to prove that he was going to make the apex.
I'm with you.
So had Stroll left one car width to the inside and Sonoda had then still clattered into Stroll, in my mind, that then becomes Sonoda's fault because Stroll has left enough room for a car to exist. If that car could make that legitimate overtake and get to the apex but run no wider, then they both go through their side by side and then whatever happens next happens next. But because the car on the outside tried to take the apex, there was no room for the car on the inside to exist. We never got to see, Sonoda never got to demonstrate that he was making a clean pass.
Yeah.
The pass was cut short. Therefore, it's the car on the outside's fault, clearly Stroll's fault. And for example, Abu Dhabi, just to finish with what Carl was saying, lap one with Hamilton and Verstappen. If Hamilton and Verstappen had been side by side and Verstappen had clattered into the side of him, it would have been obvious for us all to see that that was his fault. As it happened, we kind of got to see that anyway, because we got to see where Verstappen ended up. We got to actually see where he really went, and you can then extrapolate, had Hamilton stayed alongside, Verstappen would have forced him off the track. So there's a couple of examples there where you can see it. One of them ended in a crash, one of them the other car bailed off across the runoff. But I think that's the extreme. Yeah. That's where we can start saying black and white, this is fine, this is not fine.
So with the Sonoda and the Hamilton one we talked about, had the outside car left room on the inside and then gone out to the outside, but the inside car had still then gone and hit them or then forced them off, that's kind of the outside car's only way to prove that the inside car was out of control. I actually like this. I think this is pretty consistent, Kyle. I think we're getting to a place where we can start judging these kind of inside overtakes consistently.
Yeah, we're getting there. So in those examples, another thing that the stewards have at their disposal is the data. So they can look at their data traces and their GPS and how fast they are on a particular line. So say with the Sonoda one, he may have been 5 to 6 kilometers an hour quicker going in there than he had on previous laps. So they'll use that as part of the judgment. Even if you couldn't see what the result was, where he would have ended up, they'll be like, yeah, but he was also quicker than he had been in that corner.
Yeah,
so he very would have been going. So they're looking
But you could go quicker, knowing that you then have to brake harder and do different things on the apex. So obviously, like, the telemetry on an overtaking move is going to be different to a standard lap. So I'd be slightly nervous of that. Brad?
I'd just like to throw in, this is also part of my lane system, which I haven't published, but one day I'm going to have to write this down and codify this. Yeah. But part of the kind of general theme is, at the point of contact, could either of the drivers have done something to avoid the contact?
Yeah.
And say the Sonoda example you're talking about, Sonoda could have done nothing more to avoid contact. He had potentially, we never got to see, but potentially done all in his power to stay tight to the inside, and the other car was coming towards him. The other car had every opportunity to not keep coming towards him. No, the other car was on a trajectory that was going to end in a crash, and he had the opportunity to just alter that. The car on the inside could go no further to the inside. They're already pressed up against the inside. And you can use this for when the car's on the outside as well. There's no obligation for the car on the outside to drive off track, but maybe they will for self-preservation. But if the car on the inside is continuing to move towards them, there's only one person in that situation who can avoid the contact, and it's the one moving towards the other person.
I love this. I love trying to pick apart the very soul of racing, the very soul of Formula One. We'd love your feedback. Feedback@missedapex.net or spanners@missedapex.net or matt@missedapex.net. I am getting better at reading, replying to, and addressing the listener feedback. So I'm going to go to a listener email next. Although I will say, in about 10 minutes' time, we're going to go to a pre-recorded conversation because Matt wasn't meant to be on this week. So earlier in the week, he caught up with Matthew Summerfield and they've got a 25-minute tech section, which is I've caught snippets of, very, very interesting, talking about the current state of Formula One tech. And then I believe there's a 45-hour extra patron. How long is it, Matt? How long is the extra patron-only bit?
I don't know. I ran out of computer space, so I can't calculate it.
So I will say it's not a paywall. We've not hidden the extra. What I said to them is give me your best content, give me your 25 minutes, but then inevitably they then waffle on after that. So we cut that out and we put that on as a patron bonus. So if you want to get that, patreon.com/missedapex. I wouldn't say tech time's the reason to sign up to Patreon, but well, you know, whatever gets you there. So we're going to get to that in about 10 minutes time. But I just want to answer Ian's email. Ian says, hi, love the podcast. Thank you, Ian. After the leave a review, after the last few safety car restarts we've seen with Verstappen in P2 alongside the leader. I think that's right, Ian. Yeah, in Abu Dhabi and as well in Jeddah. Ian continues, I wonder about his right to the track in that position. We saw Leclerc run him wide in Jeddah, but my question is there anything stopping Leclerc from just running him into the wall if he's alongside? If there's no passing under a safety car, then surely Verstappen has no right to any room alongside. Yeah, well, maybe we could just, like, you could have six cars all side by side, just slightly behind each other in theory. Now, Brad, I know that you tweeted about this, and I saw your tweet, and I actually ended up thinking it was a bit harsh on Verstappen. Has he done anything wrong?
So, yeah, you're right. I tweeted about this and I had a lot of feedback, which is good, you know, because I learned more about the intricacies of it through people's replies.
What was your initial premise?
My initial premise was that Verstappen was, again, illegally driving alongside a car during a restart. So we don't see anyone else do this. So that's the first thing. Restarts in Formula One, as far as I can remember, have been single file. You start one behind another. It's not double file restart like a NASCAR race. It's always single file. Verstappen has a couple of times, I can think of a couple of clear examples, driven alongside the car that is leading. Now, that car is supposed to be effectively at that point the pace car, the safety car. They are setting the pace for the restart. Now, the rule says, and I don't have it in front of me, but I'll paraphrase reasonably closely. The rule says that you can't do anything which could endanger or impede the restart. Now, you can read, that's one of those FIA rules that you can kind of interpret a couple of different ways. The way I read that is you can't do anything which impedes the safety car, the effective safety car, the race leader at that point, from conducting the restart the way they want to do it, which may well be warming their tires. It may well be taking the racing line or using any line they want. And by driving alongside them, even if you don't technically overtake them, although Verstappen did overtake Hamilton at Abu Dhabi and was not penalized for it, you are impeding their ability to conduct the restart in the way that they want to. And you could argue it is endangering the restart, because if that driver isn't expecting you there and they try and take a line or warm their tires or something, you could then make contact. But at the very least, it's certainly not a standard way to perform a restart. And it's not the way that we've become accustomed to them happening. And I know in a lot of areas, Verstappen has, you know, tested the rules, stretched the rules to their kind of limit of what you can get away with. But I think it's probably pretty obvious that given the two different scenarios, people doing whatever the heck they want and being alongside each other, or single file, one of those is safe and straightforward to follow and police. And one of them is someone kind of harrying and bullying the leader to try and gain an advantage. And I know as race director, which one of those I would stamp out.
Kyle?
Yeah, this is quite interesting. I agree with Brad on this. I don't think it's not really on. I mean, Danny points out in the chat that Montoya used to pull alongside. Now, it's quite hard to word the rules for this. So I do think the important thing is it's saying single file, which is one after the other. I think how everyone would interpret that, rather than overlapped. Now, they can't put a rule in saying you can't overlap, because they all overlap when they're jostling for position. But as we saw in Abu Dhabi last year, Verstappen was affecting the ability of the pace setter, which was Hamilton at the time, his chance to restart as he wanted, because he pinned him up on the inside of the curb and he couldn't go as wide as he wanted. We saw it again in Jeddah, although Charles Leclerc was very, very intelligent the way he went about it. He basically walked Verstappen right out to the outside of the track and almost off the track.
I'm pretty sure he also did it at Bahrain, so I think that's actually now the last three races.
Okay, thanks for that. It's going to be interesting. They might have to do some sort of mid-season wording change or an agreement or a directive to say you cannot draw alongside or draw at least halfway alongside the car in front, because at times it's almost front wheels level with them. And in my understanding of safety car restarts, that's not really on. But, you know, in Verstappen's defense, there's nothing in the rules that says he can't do it. He maximizes and pushes everything to the absolute limit. So, of course, until he's actually pulled up and they say you cannot do that, he's going to carry on doing it. He's found an exploit and he's exploiting it.
The tricky part for me, Kyle, is that there is a very explicit part which says you're not allowed to overtake the leader, which he has overstepped in the past and not been penalized for that either. So you can kind of understand him thinking, well, I can do kind of whatever I want in these situations and I never even get a warning for it or get pulled up on it. So, and it is giving him, I know it hasn't worked out for him recently, but it is potentially giving him an advantage. You know, he's doing it for a reason. He's not just doing it for fun. And I think Leclerc did deal with it quite well by effectively like running him fully out of track. Like, no. But it would be pretty straightforward, wouldn't it? Just to say restarts must be single file. And the only time you could draw alongside someone is if effectively the car in front has braked erratically and you've had to take avoiding action. You can kind of argue that one away. That is also in the rules. You're not allowed to accelerate or brake erratically or unpredictably.
Well, yeah. I would like to throw out there that if the lead car effectively becomes the safety car, well, what would happen if the lead driver drove alongside the safety car? Is that in any way, shape, or form allowed? No, you have to follow the safety car. And so to me, right alongside, all we're talking about, a simple clarification, including following the lead car becomes the safety car, you solve that problem. That said, it is kind of genius from Verstappen to do that. I love Leclerc's response to it.
Yeah, and going back to what Bradley mentioned earlier, it's a culture thing. So if the race director starts immediately getting on the radio and saying, tell Max he cannot do that, like he cannot do that, stop it, and we'll sort the rules out. And once they've had that direction from race control during a race, they have to kind of adhere to it, really. And if we want to open that can of worms, the race director can apparently do what he likes on the safety car under the old rulings.
Too soon!
So you know, you could argue that way. And as Matt says, you know, it's, you can't blame Verstappen for doing this. Yeah, it's a bit out of order and not really on, but he's not being pulled up on it. There's nothing definitively that says he can't, and he's still not getting pulled up on it. So of course he's going to keep doing it, because it does put massive pressure onto the person sort of leading. So it's a clever way, if not very gentlemanly way, to go about it. It's exploiting everything. It's very Michael Schumacher, like absolutely exploiting every nook and cranny you can. But is it too far? Well, I don't know. I agree. I don't think it's on. And yeah. I think they should clarify and say, look, you have to stay behind. You are not allowed to overlap unless it's accentuating circle or force majeure. You know, unless you've got brake checks and you can't avoid overlapping, you must not overlap.
For context, Kyle talking about, is it gentlemanly? Like, Kyle is pathetically gentlemanly to a fault. Like, all his racing friends tease him relentlessly about, oh, that's not fair. Go on, no, you four go past. No, that was awfully unsporting of me to be fast like that through that corner. So just want the context to Kyle's comment. Matt, and I think the final thing would be maybe to clear up what was going on with Perez and Sainz, because I didn't understand any of that.
Okay, well, the situation is actually very simple. Because of the layout at Jeddah, where the safety car line is exiting the pits, is difficult to see when you're on track. Signs, because you're allowed to race up out of the pits until you hit that line, until you hit the exit of the pits, was trying to get ahead of Perez, and actually was a full car length ahead of him when they hit the safety car line. But because there's a turn there, Perez actually gained position, ran Sainz wide so he couldn't come onto the track, and wound up ahead of him. So, too long, don't read. Perez winds up overtaking Sainz under the safety car. No one's going to argue about that. That's what happened.
Okay. So, like, I somehow missed this in like decades of watching Formula One, and I've heard the term safety car line, but at least now I think I understand it. If there's a safety car and there's people pitting, there's a line at the end of the pit lane, and whoever's ahead when the car leaving the pits, if you get to that point, whichever cars you're ahead of, you stay ahead of. The thing being that you're likely to have less momentum than the cars that are coming round the track, and so therefore you have that. Yeah, so why wasn't that just sorted out on the spot? Because you could run the replay. What's this VRS that we've been hearing about, where they said they can just reverse stuff and look at the video? Why didn't they just look at the video and go, yeah, Perez was behind, swap?
Well, this is kind of the thing I was complaining about, because we don't know. All we know is that it was looked at and it was said at the end of the race, oh, we examined it, the place was given back. But the problem that everybody at the time had with it was the place wasn't given back till after the safety car restart. And so the question is, why did it take that long to look at a simple replay and say, nope, you got to give the place back? Places have been given back before under the safety car. It happened, I think, at Abu Dhabi, at Jeddah last year, in fact, with Hamilton and Ocon, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, guys, I think we have put the world to rights. We've solved the racing rules down the inside. no thanks to Brad. I think we've done a good job here today. We would love to hear what you guys think in the YouTube comments. And also, we would just love it if you would just share missedapex.net with your friends. Even if you've got 2 followers, even if you've got 2 million followers, any tweet, Facebook post, recommending it to someone at work, that's the kind of low-level campaign that we've been running for the last 8 years. And that's basically the only way that we can spread word of mouth. It's our most effective tool. You're a bunch of tools. You're our effective tool for making our way in the world in the iTunes charts. I believe in America, we got to 27 in the iTunes charts, and something very similar in the UK sports charts as well. So this word of mouth thing, it's working. Please tell your friends that Missed Apex isn't that bad. Share missedapex.net. And you can follow our panel, Race Driver Guy, Brad Philpott, at Bradley Philpott on Twitter. And you've got your t-shirt says BRKC. That's the British Rental Karting Championship, which you run and is awesome. And we can watch live, can't we?
You can. It's next weekend. So we'll have live footage covered on Motorsport TV and also on our YouTube channel. So just search for, I think our YouTube channel name is British Kart or maybe British Championship. I think we've got quite a good handle on YouTube. But anyway, just search for BRKC and you'll see all the action live next weekend. It's actually the grand final will be exactly when you're recording the next Missed Apex episode.
Don't
watch Missed Apex. Watch the grand final of the BRKC.
Okay, that's more antagonistic than I wanted it to be. Matt, maybe we could get a link to the show notes below as well. Kyle, at Kyle Power F1 on Twitter. You're not racing in the British Rental Kart Championships, which you normally do.
Yeah, I normally race. Although the last time we did it, I was your number 2 in the pit lane reporting.
Oh yeah,
and that was quite good. It was quite different because obviously I've raced. I've got through to semi-finals a couple of times. I know what it's like, so it's nice to catch the drivers as they come out and ask it how it went from their point of view. But unfortunately, I'm away and I can't make it this weekend. But I will try to make it next year so I can be embarrassed by world champions on the indoor circuit.
Yeah, exactly. No, it is a really, really high standard. So do check out BRKC. Matt is still at MattPT55. His wife, who you should follow because she writes interesting books, is at AWeaverWrites. The links to all the show notes below, the links to everything we've talked about appear in the show notes below. Magically somehow. I've got no idea who does it, but they do just magically appear. So do go and follow our panel. Go and follow Brad, Kyle and Matt Trumpets. And we've got Tech Time coming up now. Don't tune out. It's super interesting. It's going to answer a lot of your questions about the state of F1 2022 tech. So we'll be back shortly after I press all the correct buttons in all the right orders.
It's time for tech, and once again, our presence is graced by the hardest working man in tech F1, Matthew Summerfield, a.k.a. Summers F1, who is technical editor at motorsport.com. It's good to see you again. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem, Matt. It's great to be on again.
Yeah, well, it's really nice to have you, and there's so much to talk about with these new regulations. What say we dive right in to the main topic?
Yeah, let's go for it.
And you know the main topic isn't going to be all your lovely aerodynamic tire squirting doodads, but it's going to be the fact that questions are being raised about the Mercedes power unit. And more so after this last weekend where we kind of saw all the Mercedes teams at the back of their respective ends of the field. And could it really just be they all randomly had terrible aero problems at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think there's competing aspects going on here, not only from a chassis side point of view, from the aerodynamic side of things, but also, obviously, as you mentioned, the power unit does seem to be a little out of kilter when you compare it to the likes of the Ferrari and Honda, who've clearly made a sizable step forward compared to where they were relative to Mercedes in the past. And then also, obviously, you have to bargain for the fact that Alpine or Renault have also made a step forward based on the fact that, you know, they hadn't really put too much development into both their chassis or power unit over the last few years. So there's a lot of juggling going on at the moment to try to get, you know, a good hold on where the actual issues are for these teams. But it's clear to see that the Mercedes teams are struggling in some respects.
Okay. And one of the observations that was made over the weekend was that they looked particularly weak in the last sector. Is it possible that their energy recovery system setup has fallen behind that of the Honda and the Ferrari, one might ask?
Yeah, I mean, I noticed it on Norris's qualifying lap, or one of Norris's qualifying laps from the onboard. You could see down the right-hand side of the steering wheel, you've got the SOC, the state of charge, and you can see how the energy is being deployed in that situation. And you could see that there was some clipping going on the straights in order to try to measure the amount of energy that's then deployed further into the lap. And as you mentioned, obviously, when they get to the end of the lap, if they're not recovering the energy they require throughout the course of the lap to top up the battery, you're going to come into this problem of having energy deployment issues. And I think Mercedes, or the Mercedes-powered teams, are having this issue because it would appear that most of the Mercedes-powered teams are all having problems with drag. Again, brought on by other issues as well. I think the biggest issue that every single team in the field is having is still the porpoising issue. And that is manifesting itself into some of this, you know, big drag penalty that we're seeing for the teams. On top of, obviously, they've missed targets with, you know, the aerodynamic configurations that they're running. We only have to look at what Mercedes did this weekend with their rear wing, you know, just taking a massive slice out the upper flap to try to mitigate those drag issues that they had.
Okay, so this brings me to my first listener-generated question, which I thought was an interesting one, although I want to loop back and talk about some other stuff in a minute, which is Maria from our patron group asked, are the engine setups each team's choice, or the works team presets it all for each team? And it seems like to me, this means we're going to have to talk about the difference between maps and modes a little bit.
Yeah, so obviously the power unit manufacturer has their own engineers embedded within each of the teams. And they make changes based upon the setup that the teams actually have as well. So they have to work side by side with the team. So that means that the maps or engine modes that each of the teams are using are different to one another, but they are dictated to them by the Mercedes engineer that's embedded within the team. So obviously they are there as a sort of safety protocol to stop the team running the engine or the power unit too hard under certain conditions so that you end up with a total failure on your hands. Obviously, you still end up with those situations, as we saw over the course of this weekend, in fact, but it's there to try to add that sort of firewall for the team so that they can't just run the engine at full tilt all the time and then lay the blame at the power unit manufacturer's corner when things do go wrong.
Okay, so but basically there's room for the teams to adapt how the power unit runs to their particular needs, what they think will be the fastest way around the track for them, where they recover, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, as you can understand, each of the Mercedes, if we're taking Mercedes as an example here, each of those teams within that stable have their own coefficient of drag on their car. So how they are setting their car up for the weekend based on, you know, the downforce or the drag that they're running in particular, then they want the power unit to work within that those parameters as well to get the best from it. So there's always going to be a bit of a trade-off between aero and power unit. But as I say, that engineer that's embedded with the team will make some of those decisions and help the team to extrapolate the best they can for their particular arrangement of power unit and the chassis side.
Okay. And now how does that relate to, like, we used to hear about party mode, but then we also hear about engine maps. Could you just maybe sort that out so that people understand what's probably incorrectly being talked about when the TV commentators get into it?
Okay, so obviously party mode was something that we used to have back in the day where qualifying, you could run a different engine mode to what you can throughout the course of the race. So now the engine modes are fixed. You can't run a different engine mode in qualifying to what you can in the race. That means that you can't do some of the exorbitant tricks that used to go on in terms of the way that the fuel was run, the oil was sent into the combustion chamber, and a plethora of other tricks that were happening around that kind of era. However, the drivers still have tools at their disposal whilst they're out on track to be able to make adjustments. So you have different settings on rotaries or buttons, etc., that the driver can select to try to minimise the problems that they might encounter. For argument's sake, they might use a little bit too much energy whilst they're out there in a preparation lap, or don't recover enough, and then you have to compensate for that during the course of the qualifying lap. So there's always adjustments being made in order that obviously you can get the best possible performance out of the power unit, depending on the trim that you're currently running in.
Okay, thanks a lot. I hope that helps clear it up for people a little bit. The power unit, if I'm understanding, I'm just going to restate it to make sure I understand it. The power unit can only be run in one mode, is what I'm going to call it, or one setting. But inside of that setting, teams can make different ways to run it that might be more fuel efficient or recover more energy more quickly, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's all about getting the right balance. And that's obviously especially important during the course of a race where you might want to deploy more energy on one lap because you're chasing down one of your rivals, but then know that that's going to give you a penalty into the next lap. So you'll have to charge with a more aggressive harvesting energy mode to recover what you've lost throughout the course of it. That's what you call state of charge, you know, the difference between the levels of energy that you have available to you at any one point.
Okay, I'm going to go back and ask real quick. In terms of drag, one thing we have heard that I think is kind of obvious is that one solution to the porpoising that everybody's trying to solve is just simply to run the car higher so it doesn't bounce off the ground as much. What kind of a drag penalty are we looking at there? If this is something the Mercedes, well, you know, in particular is afflicted by, and they're having to run the car higher, is that like a lot more than, say, putting a Monaco spec wing on at Monza or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has more issues involved in that because it's not a static problem. You have to think about the way in which that the car behaves over the course of a lap. So teams will work on a generalized aero map for the entire circuit. But obviously, that then just feeds into problems that you have in certain corners. So having this porpoising issue obviously makes it more difficult when you're having it over a large range of conditions as well. So as you say, when you raise the ride height, then that kind of feeds back into having both downforce loss. You know, that you don't just have to think about drag. We're talking about a reduction in downforce as well by raising the ride height. So you're going to lose downforce in some of the key areas of the circuit where you really want it. And then on top of that, you know, you then carry the penalty of having additional drag on the car as well, which is, as you say, tantamount to running a much higher wing angle. And that obviously then penalises you down the straights. You have to consider how much they are down, if we're talking about the Mercedes-powered teams again, in the speed traps when you compare them to the Ferrari and the Honda, for example. We're talking sort of 10 kilometres an hour. It's a huge difference in terms of straight line speed. And obviously the teams will have to work towards trying to minimise that so that they can get that performance back without losing speed in the corners as well. So it's a really difficult problem to solve. And, you know, it's not something that you can ultimately solve at the track with what they've got available at their disposal right now. So they're kind of in a trade-off position where they're having to just take what they've got right now and run with it and deal with it. And then when we get into some of the races down the line, we might start to see some performance parts coming in that can sort of deal with those issues.
Okay, great. Before we leave this topic, I sort of want to combine the question of, is it also possibly a bit of a fuel issue for them? I know that was talked about a lot. And if it is there anything left for them to do about it? And my other question would be, is this just what happens when everybody has an engine that's as good as the Mercedes engine has been since 2014?
Yeah, I mean, it is a compound problem because if you've got more drag than your initial target, then that technically means that you're going to have to save fuel. So you're going to have to do more lift and coast. And I think that's something that kind of goes under the radar at the moment because of the type of racing that we're seeing. But they're all at that they're all doing lift and coast in certain circumstances to try to save fuel. Because as we know, you want to run the car as light as possible. So you want to run with as least fuel as possible. In order that you can make that trade-off in lap time, weight versus lap time. And that's the difficulty, is finding the very small area of performance that is the least trade-off. And I think that's perhaps where Mercedes have done well over the course of the last two races, because they've still managed to get relatively decent finishes, albeit pretty far off the pace.
Okay, well, let's move on then and talk a little bit about Ferrari and Red Bull. They seem to have a very different solution for this particular track. And it seems like Red Bull ran the slippier, more slippy solution, I guess we would say.
Yeah, so most of the teams had new rear wings available for them in Jeddah because it is realistically considered one of the lower downforce arrangements for throughout the course of the season because of the high-speed nature of the track. But obviously you don't want to go too low because of the high-speed corners and the trade-off that you then inevitably have there. However, as you mentioned, Red Bull and Ferrari both had lower downforce wings available to them this weekend. However, Red Bull had a new lower downforce rear wing arrive in Bahrain. So this one is a step further that they took into Jeddah. And I think Ferrari were kind of caught out in that respect because they bought what they considered a lower downforce wing, but it was still quite substantially higher downforce than their rivals over at Red Bull. So then you end up in this situation where Ferrari mentioned the fact of tyre deg as well. They were concerned going into this particular track that they needed to be considerate of how much tyre degradation they would have. And so they chose not to run a really low downforce wing because they had that other consideration going on in the back of their mind. And you could say in some respects then, did Red Bull gamble? Because that low downforce wing wasn't on the car initially. They ran the Bahrain one and then made the switch. And it's again something that they did as a tactical or strategic aspect against Mercedes last year, where they'd wait a little bit to deploy a lower downforce wing to try to, you know, fox them into a situation where you're gambling one scenario against another. And I think that's something we're going to see throughout the course of this season, is that because those two teams are so closely matched, at least at the moment in terms of performance, that they're going to kind of have to go toe-to-toe in terms of strategy and tactics on aero as well.
Okay, so here's one of my favorite questions, and I'm going to use this wing as an example. So did both Verstappen and Perez use this new super ultra-low downforce wing? And to make my multi-part question complete, are they running basically the same cars this season for the first time and since whenever we've talked about Red Bull and the two different drivers?
Yes, is the answer. They both had very similar setups this weekend. Obviously, there's always going to be differences between the two because of their natural driving style. They will set their cars up differently. But in terms of the aero configuration that we saw on both cars, both of them ran that new lower downforce rear wing. So, you know, they both had equal machinery rather than what we've seen in the past where Verstappen tends to get all the new tricks straight out of the box.
All right. The last thing I want to ask about a little bit is DRS, because, I mean, boy, you could not avoid people saying DRS is too powerful. We need to rethink it. And aside from the classical racing arguments about DRS or, you know, any performance balancing aid, it seemed like to me that it wasn't just an automatic pass as it frequently was in seasons gone by. But why are they saying this? And do you agree with it? And if so, what kind of changes do you think we'll be looking at for future races and how might that affect the racing?
Okay, so I think the biggest issue that I would take away from Jeddah in terms of DRS is that we have to remember that we've got sort of two zones very close to one another. So you can kind of eke your way up to the other driver in the first zone, back out of it, which is eventually what Max decided to do to complete the pass, and then use the full deployment of DRS and obviously all the energy resources at his hands down the main straight. I do, however, think that the main straight DRS was overpowered in some respects. For me personally, I believe that DRS should allow drivers to close the gap to the point where they can race wheel to wheel. And it just seemed that it was just slightly too powerful compared to what we might have seen in the past. Now, if we reverse back to when DRS was first brought into the sport in 2011, we used to have a situation where on a Friday, the race director would monitor what was happening with DRS. And if he felt it was too powerful, he would adjust the zone accordingly. We would probably have 20 or 30 meters taken off of the zone or increased in length in order to try to balance out what they thought at the time was obviously going to give the best kind of racing. And we kind of fell out of that pattern because of cost issues and the teams saying that it was being used tactically, etc. However, I do think that throughout the course of this season, it might be an idea to think about going back down that route. If we're going to see this sort of consecutive DRS zone scenario again, just to try to balance things out. But what I did like is the fact that obviously the cars could follow more closely. And then that obviously then meant that the DRS effectively becomes a little bit too powerful when compared with what was going on in the past. So I think there's a multifaceted argument to go on in terms of whether DRS was too overpowered or not. And I think you also have to think about the tyre situation that evolved during the course of that battle as well. So there's lots of things to think about.
Okay. Last thing I want to talk about from a technical point of view is a little development that you found, which is the sprung bib or splitter. And I'm going to just ask you straight up, is that part of the answer to the porpoising problem, do you think? Or is that just because certain teams want to run at a higher rake angle and they're just going to be banging off the floor more if they do that?
A bit of both, really, if I'm honest, Matt. And you look at which teams actually have these sprung mechanisms in the bib, and it is Ferrari, Red Bull, Haas, Alfa Romeo, and a couple of the others have variants, but not to the large degree that we're seeing the others that I've just mentioned have. So effectively what happens here, we've seen stays used in the past on the bibs to prevent the bib colliding with the track and then causing a rebound situation. However, the rules do allow them this year to have what is determined in the regulations as a device. So, you know, each of them has their own interpretation of what these sprung devices are. Ferrari have a damper situation. Red Bull have a Belleville spring situation and Haas have a coil spring. So they've all got different ways of dealing with what they're trying to do. But effectively what they're doing is they're allowing the bib to collide with the track, but not stay in collision with it as long as you would if you have, say, a normal type of metal stay between the bib and the chassis. So it's a very interesting situation there that's arisen. It's interesting that those particular teams that I've mentioned seem to be better on the porpoising end of the scale and seem to have the best ride and adaptability in terms of setup. So I do think that we will see a lot of the other teams develop down that route. I don't think it's the silver bullet, but I do think it might offer some way towards helping deal with the problems at hand.
Okay, because, I mean, to me, right off, that suggests that you're absorbing energy that would otherwise be directly transmitted into the chassis and into the heave element. So it seems like it could potentially help interrupt the feedback cycle that we see when the cars have that behavior. And this leads me to sort of my last question is, you mentioned Ferrari. But it sure seemed like Carlos Sainz was bouncing a lot more than our friend Leclerc there. Do you have any insight as to, other than just, well, he had a different setup, any ideas why that might be the case?
Well, yeah, I mean, the obvious answer there is he was running a different setup because each of the drivers have their own ways to deal with these situations. But on his end of the scale, he was clearly suffering more. And you know, Ferrari will be looking at that in order that they can try and move him closer towards what Leclerc was running to get a better handle on the car. Because, you know, it's not a one-dimensional thing. It has consequences in terms of tyre wear, tyre degradation. It has consequences in terms of the drag level. It then feeds back into how the power unit operates. So, you know, it's something that they need to get a handle on, just as all of the teams do. But if Carlos couldn't deal with certain characteristics that Leclerc could in the way in which he drives the car, then obviously you are going to end up with this slightly diverging setup. And I think that's where we find both Carlos and Charles during the course of that race weekend.
Oh, so he might have inadvertently given Ferrari some a new path to follow in terms of solving the issue better. I will say it does look like Red Bull have the best overall solution right now. And on the way out the door here, I want to ask you about my favorite thing, which is convergence. In years gone by, we've changed regulations and we've seen interesting asymmetrical nose results. But usually over the course of a season, there is a favored solution. So I know these are really big new regs, so we may not see it this season. But are you, I know we've had side pod updates and this, that, and the other. Are you starting to see that there's some solutions that the teams will want to be favoring over others yet? Or are we just going to have to wait a little bit longer for that particular piece of candy?
I think we will be waiting slightly longer for that piece of candy whilst they figure out which one is actually the best route to follow. Obviously, all of the teams will be monitoring each of their designs in order to try to see if there's performance to be found adding it to their own car. But it's not a case of taking one Lego brick and putting it in place of another Lego brick. It's something that you have to kind of work on. As we've seen already with Alpine, they've already made changes to their side pod. Aston Martin have made changes to their side pod in order to try to improve what they already have. And I think that's what we might start to see initially before we start to see sort of a major convergence to one solution when the teams really do understand how to get the best from the overall package.
All right, so we have Australia coming up. Before I tell everyone where to find you on the internet, and they probably know anyway because I'm sure they listen to all of this segment, who's bringing what to Australia? I've heard Mercedes might have a floor. Anything else we should be on the lookout for?
Basically, just look across the entire field. I expect quite a few of the teams to have interesting bits coming into Australia, but I really do think that the biggest portion of development we're going to see is when we return back to Europe, to be honest. Now, that's the classic place to start adding upgrades because it's when the teams have really started to digest the information that they've collected during testing. They've readdressed any issues that they've had through the course of the first few races. And then, obviously, they can start to really pile on the performance. But yeah, as you mentioned, I do expect to see Mercedes with a new floor. And I do expect quite a few bits to arrive at the third race of the season.
Excellent. Well, why don't you tell everyone where they can look to follow all these latest updates when they pop up on track?
Well, best place as always is to follow me on Twitter, which is SummersF1, but you can also find my work over on motorsport.com as well.
Lovely. Thanks for that, Summers, and cannot wait to get you back on.
We're very lucky to have Matthew Summerfield jump on board, a mainstream media tech guru, jumping into the shed to give us all his tech knowledge. We feel very privileged. I hope you all paid attention. I hope you didn't nope out of the tech time. Don't be ashamed if you have to occasionally scroll back during tech time. I definitely do that. And it takes me a few passes, but I soak it up eventually, even if I don't remember it the following week. Thank you for tuning in to Missed Apex Podcast. We've got some great interviews coming up over the next couple of weeks, and it's going to be 8 p.m. on Tuesday that we're going to chat to Will Buxton, and then on Sunday at 8 p.m. we're going to do our Australian Grand Prix race review. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.